This is an interview with Stephen Wallman for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive, The History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas, and the date is May 15th, 2015, and we're in McLean, Virginia. Thanks very much for talking to us today. We usually start with a little bit of biographical background, where you're from, and I guess I'd be very interested in what led you into MIT, especially.
I was born and raised in New York City, and went to MIT because I wanted to be a scientist and discover things about the universe and try to make the world a better place.
Okay. Did you have any particular field that you were interested in when you went there?
When I went, I was primarily interested in theoretical physics.
Oh, okay.
And when I ended up going through MIT, I did take a heavy concentration in physics, but ended up with a lot more in what I would call the soft sciences, urban studies, political science, economics, things of that nature as well over time. And it was it's a very interesting institution. It allows you to have an awful lot of flexibility and freedom, and actually you can put together your own degree courses. So it's a great place.
Okay.
I loved it. And then at the same time, I took a lot of management courses at the Sloan School. Mm-hmm. And the year after I got my undergraduate degree, I then got my graduate degree from the Sloan School.
Okay. What sort of concentration did you pursue at the Sloan School? Because I know that there was a lot of things in options pricing and that sort of thing that came out of that milieu.
Yeah, not necessarily back then. Mm-hmm. I was at Sloan in 76, and options pricing was just sort of starting to come to the fore then. My field of interest was actually not in securities or that kind of economics at all. It was more in the, again, what I would call sort of the soft parts of it, leadership-related issues, how to think about organizational development, organizational behavior, things of that nature.
Were there a particular professor? This is an area of particular interest.
Yeah,
to me.
Professor Jonathan Van Manen at the time. I don't believe he's still there. I'm not sure if, in fact, he's still teaching. But he was a brilliant professor who really focused on a lot of organizational development activities and implications for real-world activities. So, for example, my thesis ended up being on the police and how the police interact with communities and what you can do to change the leadership perspective of the police within a community to make them a group that actually can work with the community instead of, in some cases, as we've unfortunately very recently seen, work against the community. And a lot of the ideas back then that were developed, that were being studied, such as community policing, getting police out of police cars, back onto the street, having them be part of the community itself, have been time-tested now and determined to be really excellent, but for whatever reason they continue not to be used in an awful lot of jurisdictions. And we are seeing the results of bad policing concepts in those jurisdictions today. And the headlines recently sort of prove the point. When you have a police force that's estranged from the community it's supposed to be protecting, they feel more like occupiers as opposed to protectors. And the result in the community is basically an adverse reaction. So, unfortunately, we learned a lot, we know the answers, and for whatever reason, they're not being pursued and implemented.
Right. So then after that, you went to get a law degree. Had that been your intention, or what made you decide to do that?
Actually, I went to law school at the same time I was finishing my graduate school program. So when I left MIT as an undergraduate, I matriculated at Columbia Law School and started law school. But during that first year of law school, I also finished my graduate degree at MIT from the Sloan School. So the law school degree is 78, the graduate degree from MIT is 76, the undergraduate is 75. I went to law school because at the time that I was at MIT, there was something that we now know in history as Watergate that was beginning, and the Watergate hearings were then held. And it seemed like if you really, really wanted to change the world, you could do it by being somebody involved in government, somebody who understood the law, and to be able to use the law in a good way. So I thought having a law credential and going to law school was not a sufficient nor necessary condition to being able to do really good things, but it would be a helpful degree to have in order to be able to influence the world.
Did you think you would go into public service then straight away? I noticed that you went to Covington and Burling from your resume.
I did think I would go into public service soon. I thought it would be important to have a couple of years at least of some private practice. You know, at the time, my party leanings and affiliation were as a Democrat, and at the time, some of the opportunities were more limited because of the sort of politics of the time. And so I was not able to go into government at the time I wanted, and my law career started to do quite well, and it made sense to continue to do that. At Covington then, and I suspect Covington now, and I suspect most big law firms today, the road to partnership was usually a 6, 7, or 8 year effort. And once you're reasonably down that road, and once the prospects look reasonably good, most people, I think, might make the decision, as I did, to stay the course and get the partnership.
Okay, so then you ended up in the corporate law area once you started in there.
I did. When I was at Covington, we had a number of interesting clients. One of them was the National Football League. And at that time, the NFL was increasingly engaged in what would be called sort of corporate activities, thinking about how to help finance the teams themselves, obtaining centralized loan facilities, things of that nature. And they were using Covington for their labor and antitrust and related activities, and the opportunity came up to see whether or not Covington might be able to help on the corporate security side as well. And so I was asked to start to think about some of those issues, and ended up having the privilege to really work with some really great people at the NFL, some of the team owners who were really fantastic individuals, larger-than-life personalities and very smart, very capable people who were very kind enough to let somebody a little bit junior have a chance to actually do some interesting things. So I'd started to become more involved in higher profile corporate activities because of that. In addition, Covington also had another client called, named at that time, Scott Paper Company. And Scott Paper Company was in the midst of some battles with regard to potential takeovers. And I was on the team that was looking at some of those related issues and started to become very interested in corporate governance. Some of the things that we were able to do were to rethink some of the corporate laws in this country and devise the notion that a corporation really is a series of constituencies. It's really not only just shareholders, but it's also employees, it's also vendors, it's suppliers, customers, it's the environment, the community in which they operate, etc. It's a wide range of actors that a corporation impacts. And the board of directors, in at least my view, and I think now enshrined in the corporate law in most of the states in this country, and also by casemate law in many jurisdictions that don't have it by statute, the board of directors' duty is really to the corporation, not to the shareholders, in the context of taking corporate action. And it's to maximize the long-term wealth production capability of the corporation, not simply to maximize the short-term value of the stock. That's a real distinction in terms of both mindset and culture as to how a board ought to operate. And I was in a position to be able to think through some of those issues, draft some model statutes, and actually see them get enacted across the country.
Was this manifested mainly in the question of takeovers, which was, of course, a very big issue at the time, or was that was it more widespread throughout the question of the governance of companies?
My view is it's widespread and ought to be something that's consistently considered when taking corporate action. The place where the rubber meets the road is primarily in the takeover context, because when you don't have a takeover, most times you've got a board that is thinking about how do we maximize the value of the corporation over the long term, which includes almost by necessity, how do we also make sure our employees are happy? How do we retain them? How do we obtain them in the first place? What benefits do we pay? How do we make sure They're increasingly well-trained, increasingly respected throughout the organization, and able to grow. And most companies, I think of employees as their primary asset, not as a cliche, but as a fact. And because of that, there is, I think, a general view that if you're going to build a company for the long term, you have to care about how your employees are acting and how you're treating them in the short, intermediate, and long terms. So that part, I think, is pretty clear. With regard to how you treat your customers, same thing. Treat your customers poorly in the short term, you're not going to have them in the long term. Treat them well in the short term, hopefully you'll have them in the long term, and you can continue to grow the company. Same thing with suppliers. Keep squeezing them down to the point where they can't work with you anymore, they won't. And so I think there's this traditional and consistent balance in most day-to-day operations of looking at the long term and thinking about the various constituencies and making sure things are balanced and reasonably fair. When it comes to a takeover, though, all that changes. All of a sudden, there had been, and I think in the view of some still today, and I think it's unfortunate, I think it's wrong, there is a view that once a takeover is on the table, somebody says, I can increase shareholder value, everything switches to nothing but how do you increase shareholder value in the short term. And I think it's a terrible mistake. I think it's bad for the country. I think it's bad for corporate governance generally. I think it's bad for sort of the notion of capitalism in particular. And these statutes were designed to ensure that certainly when the rubber meets the road, mm-hmm. boards feel empowered to be able to look at the long term as opposed to simply the short term stock price.
Would that tend to show up in defense against takeovers, or is it more complex than that?
It should be more complex than that. Again, sort of the obvious place and the place where most people would think of it would be in the defense against takeovers, where somebody is saying, I'm offering a premium for this company's stock. How can they say that that's not the right thing for them to now do? And what the intent was for the board to be able to look at that and say, premium is obviously excellent. It helps the shareholders. The question is, where does the premium come from? If the premium is coming from the ability to have true synergies, to add value to the corporation as a whole, to build it better because the acquiring company has greater reach, greater marketing prowess, greater intellectual property that can add to the mix of what the target company has, or other kinds of things, then clearly you might have a really wealth-producing, wealth-maximizing transaction that makes sense to go forward with. On the other hand, if the reason why they're offering the extra dollars on the premium is because they can bankrupt part of it, lay off a whole bunch of other people, shut down a whole bunch of other activities, and do things for the very short term that will let them pay off some debt, make some money, but in the meantime you've destroyed communities and destroyed relationships that have been built up as, in essence, implicit contracts over a very long period of time, then it's not wealth production capability. It's not wealth maximizing at all. It's actually wealth minimizing. That's, therefore, a difficult set of calculations to go through and to understand what the real values are and what the detriments are and come to a conclusion as to whether or not it's enhancing or a detrimental activity go forward with it.
In a totally different context, I've run into the use of an ESOP as a defense mechanism, but of course that also entails increasing employee ownership. Did that show up in your work in this area?
Not in particular. ESOPs were certainly a way to have a tactical mechanism to put control of the company into the hands of a constituency, in this case the employees, and that has the effect of making a takeover more difficult or potentially even impossible in some cases, depending on how it's structured. That has that impact. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that a deal that would have made sense to go forward with and should have been something that people would have embraced doesn't get embraced or does. I mean, it's sort of a separate issue. It's more of a tactic as opposed to an answer to the overall question.
Now, your interest in the impact of technology on market structure, did that begin to develop in this era when you were working in law?
No. That developed later when I was at the SEC.
Oh, okay.
The things that continued to develop while at Covington related to more of the governance area, the takeover area, things of that nature. And as I became more and more interested in the public policies underlying corporate law and the securities laws. It sort of reinforced my initial view from years earlier that I really did want to go into government and really did want the opportunity to serve in government.
Okay. Another thing from your bio is you mentioned the National Football League, also the Business Roundtable, which is a very interesting organization from the securities regulation standpoint. What was that work about?
Yeah, some of the activities that I had engaged in terms of the state corporate constituency statutes and various types of sort of looking at how boards of directors and others can best implement the concept of maximizing long-term wealth production capabilities for the companies within the context of caring about the environment and the context of communities, employees, and others. Was something that started to resonate with some of the Business Roundtable folks who at the time were looking at some issues being raised by people like Boone Pickens and others that were suggesting that the law really ought to be made very clear that the duty of the board is simply to maximize share price, period. And to their credit, a number of the Business Roundtable leaders back then, and I suspect, you know, it's not a tradition that has died out, and I suspect that people continue to believe this, thought that there was more to it than simply that, and were intrigued by some of the work that I had done in this area and asked if I could also help represent them in the context of some of the corporate governance activities that the Business Roundtable itself engaged in as an organization. In addition to that, I also ended up working closely with the AFL-CIO on these same kinds of issues because, as you might expect, they also had a strong interest in thinking about whether or not corporations owe some duty to employees or how employees' interests can be best taken into account in the context of corporate decisions, whether takeovers or otherwise. So, you know, I had the chance to work with people at the AFL-CIO, who I respected greatly. They're not there at this time anymore, but they were some absolutely terrific people and some people who were just terrific at the Business Roundtable.
Okay, is there anything else from your time at Covington and Burling that you'd like to emphasize before we move on to your time at the SEC?
There were so many interesting things at Covington. I mean, the other thing that was helpful at Covington was the opportunity to see a lot of small companies. Covington had a practice at that time that was generally very large companies, very large organizations. Covington had a sterling reputation for being one of the best and still one of the best firms in Washington, D.C. But it was also interested in starting to expand its presence in other areas. And so I had the opportunity, for example, to open the first office that I think Covington ever had outside of the downtown Washington area, which was a office actually not far from here in McLean in Tyson's Quarter. And the concept was to see if we could start to build a practice around smaller companies, startups, entrepreneurial companies that were beginning at that time to be part of this area. And so that gave me a lot of visibility into the problems that small companies had with regard to capital formation, how difficult it was for them to raise capital, how difficult it was for them to comply with a lot of the securities laws that were really designed for much larger organizations, how they were stymied by some laws that really hadn't been put to the test in terms of how they impact smaller companies, smaller issuers, and really seemed designed more to protect large incumbent broker-dealers and their franchise with regard to capital raising as opposed to really assisting issuers who wanted to engage in capital formation. So it was interesting to see it from that side and to see the difficulties and some of the rules that really seemed to make very little sense, but were there. It seemed more to be methods of maintaining the roles of gatekeepers and maintaining their franchise and their payments, as opposed to really facilitating either capital formation on the one side or investor protection on the other side.
Is it a pretty continuous line from your work in that area to your decision to create the company where we're sitting now, Folio, in this area. Was that kind of continuous interest of yours? And this particular area, which is known as kind of the Washington, D.C. tech startup area.
There are two parts to your question, perhaps. One is sort of the notion of, is the geography relevant from that time to now? The geography is relevant in the sense that, quite honestly, I live here and have lived here for a long time. And so when I left the SEC to start a company, it seemed to make sense to start it where I knew where I was going to be living. So so that one was, I wish I could give you some more deeper meaning than that, but it was the time I left, I decided to go home and work from home.
So evidently sensible.
So just was that. But with regard to the substance of the startup, with regard to the substance of what Folio does, yes, it was very much a straight line in the sense of having a real great concern for sort of smaller companies, smaller firms, individual investors, trying to think about how you can make individual investors advantaged as opposed to disadvantaged by the securities laws and by what we could do to put in place various things to really allow individuals to have better opportunities to do the things that we think that they should be able to do, to deploy their capital, to obtain wealth over time, to pay for retirement, to pay for education, to pay for medical expenses, all the things that we all think of in this country as making this country sort of work in terms of people being able to accumulate some savings and wealth so that they can retire in a proud way and with the resources needed to have a good life and to be able to send kids to college and do the other things that we think of as part of the sort of continuation of the generations. That all sort of relies on people being able to be treated fairly at work and then to be treated fairly in terms of what they accumulate from work in terms of their investments. Both the corporate activities I engaged in when I was at Covington and the activities I engaged in while at the SEC and then this company all have that constant theme of how do we facilitate, enable, and empower those kinds of activities.
Okay, well, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves and skip the crucial step, which is, of course, the SEC. Just how did your opportunity to be on the commission come about?
I'm not sure I'm actually the best person to answer that question. I know some of what I've been informed of, but I'm not sure I actually know for sure. There were some people that I knew from various organizations that I think thought that I would be a good candidate for the commission. My political affiliations were, I think, fairly put, weak. I did not work on the Hill. I did not work in the executive branch. I did not have a senator as a patron or somebody in the executive branch who was willing to go to the mat for my candidacy. I think I just got lucky. There were a number of people who knew me or knew of me, and I think were kind enough to suggest that if there's nobody else in particular, you might want to take a look at this guy. And maybe it was just a time when there was nobody else in particular. I'm not exactly sure. I know a lot of people worked hard, and a few people worked very hard to try to advance my nomination. And I respect them for it tremendously, and I think they really deserve all the credit for my having gotten there.
On the Hill or more generally?
More generally. They were not on the Hill. Okay. And not in the executive branch. They were in private, they were in the private sector, if you will, in organizations that were, lobbying organizations or charitable organizations or others that just thought that I could bring a good perspective to the commission. And I thank them very much for their faith.
So who are you contacted by initially?
The initial contact from the Office of White House Personnel was a woman there who was in charge of the vetting for this position, who called and said, quite candidly, she said, I don't know you. We've never met. We've never talked. And nobody seems to know that much about you, except a number of people keep mentioning your name. And it keeps showing up from a number of different places. When we've talked to some people from the corporate community, they seem to be quite high on you. When we talk to some people from the labor community, they seem to be quite high on you. When we talk to some people from the investor community, they seem to be quite high on you. And she said, quite honestly, we've never seen somebody who seems to be high on the list from labor and corporate and investor communities all at the same time.
Okay.
Usually, they're mirror images. People that labor wants are not the people the corporate side wants, and people that the corporate side wants are not people the labor side wants. And she said, this is the first time we've ever seen somebody show up on all three lists. So with the institutional investors at the same time. So she said, we aren't saying anything, but I'd like to meet you. So I went down and spent an afternoon and left and figured it was a nice interview. And then I don't remember quite how long it was. It was probably a few weeks afterwards. I got a call back saying, would you like to be an SEC commissioner? And I said, sure. And they said, well, we're thinking of going forward. Are you willing to talk to the FBI and fill out some background stuff, et cetera? And I said, sure. And the process went from there.
And the confirmation was pretty smooth?
The confirmation took some time. Even back then, I think that they were already starting to get into some of the partisan politics. But certainly not anything close to what is there today.
This was in early 1994.
Correct.
So the election hadn't occurred yet when the Republicans swept in.
Correct.
Yeah.
What did happen is there was a little bit of a holdup in that some of the plaintiff's lawyers were of the view that since Covington as a firm did a lot of defense work on some of the asbestos litigation and some other things, there was this view that Covington was sort of any plaintiff's lawyers. I didn't do any litigation. I didn't have any involvement in anything related to sort of the litigation side of things. I was a corporate securities lawyer. I think it ended up with my actually meeting with some of the plaintiff's lawyers and their representatives, where they said, were you involved in this case or this case or this case? And quite honestly, I hadn't heard of most of the cases they were talking about. So the answer was no. I really don't have any particular view on sort of the trial lawyer type issues, and I've not been involved in any of them, and they're not in any of the things I've done in the past. Once I think that got clarified, whatever hold there was on the Hill with regard to my nomination that the plaintiff's lawyers had asked for got lifted, and then the confirmation went forward.
Okay. Now, when you arrived at the commission, I guess there were probably four commissioners there, but it soon shrank down to just you and Chairman Leavitt?
I think when it first arrived, I think there were five.
Oh, yeah.
I think we had a full commission, but it was short-lived. And it then shrank down to four, and then three, and then it was just me and Chairman Leavitt.
So that's kind of a unique situation. How did that kind of work itself out in practice? I know that there were some concerns about whether or not you could even legitimately act as a two-person commission. But then, of course, I've read a little bit, just snippets of your style versus Chairman Leavitt's style. I'm wondering if you can expand on that at all.
The legal questions, I think we got pretty comfortable that as long as we had a majority of the then sitting commissioners, which would mean by definition two out of two, because one and one would not have been a majority on either side, that as long as there was a majority, meaning two, voting in favor of something, then we were reasonably convinced from what General Counsel was telling us that that was an acceptable quorum and an acceptable and legally enforceable action on our part. So the legal questions we thought were raised appropriately and reviewed appropriately and dismissed appropriately. With regard to the sort of action within the commission, from the standpoint of a commissioner, obviously it's a wonderful experience because if you're the only other vote and the only commissioner, it does provide a little bit more of an opportunity for you to weigh in on areas that if you're one of five votes, perhaps your view gets diluted, obviously, by the fact that there are four others. And so you can lose those votes by 4-1 or 3-2. But if there are only two votes and both of them have to be in favor of something for it to happen, then your view becomes a little bit more important just because of the math. That notwithstanding, I don't think there were very many issues that I and the chairman actually disagreed on. I think we had very similar views on many, many things. We may have had somewhat different approaches to some of those views. But the goal that I think each of us had was pretty well shared by the other. So there were some things that I thought were important. I thought it was very important, for example, to work on some of the capital formation issues. And so I ended up chairing the first advisory committee on capital formation that the commission had. And some of its recommendations and some of the directions that it was suggesting the securities laws move in ended up actually being adopted over the next decade and a half. Some of them in terms of things like some of the S3 registrations that basically, because of the way shelf has developed over time, really are pretty close to what we had proposed in terms of company registration as a concept. Still a little bit more complex than what's needed if you just did company registration. We had proposed a whole concept of registering companies, not securities, that would eliminate some of the transaction-based sort of complexity of the current structure and make it much more more streamlined and simplified. But the current process, within at least sort of an order of magnitude, directionally moved into the same place that we had suggested. Some of the things that have now come out as part of the Jobs Act were other things that we had also talked about and had suggested. So I feel quite proud about all that we've moved in the direction that I think that committee suggested, albeit under different names with other kinds of nomenclature and semantics, and over a time frame that I think was long compared to what we could have done had we just moved forward. But things take some time to acclimate, and things take some time to actually move through the process. In addition to that, one of the other issues that I thought was important to take on at the time was the whole issue of technology. The internet was coming into its fore, really sort of beginning to have a real presence. People were starting to use electronic means to communicate much more. And so many of the commission's roles were premised on the notion of paper. There are some things where I have some strong views on how rulemaking should be done. We'll get to that a little bit later. But many of the commission's rules, because they were premised on the concept of paper and physical delivery of things, it really just didn't make any sense in an era that was starting at that point to dawn, where companies, investors, and others were starting to use electronic communications means. So I tried to, and I think we succeeded quite admirably, rethink how the whole concept of sort of what the core mission of the SEC is in terms of disclosure and dissemination of information, how that would work in a paperless world. And we created at that time, the electronic communications rules, which really sort of, I think, revolutionized the ability to comply with the securities laws in a much, much more efficient mechanism using electronic means as compared to using paper means. So that was sort of a watershed in terms of getting people to change their thinking and to start to think about the future, about technology, about innovation. And it was really, although the rules themselves that we changed are not ones that I would call groundbreaking. I think they're sort of obvious on their face as to the concepts. Getting that change within the commission really took the effort of sort of having people embrace a potentially new cultural shift of thinking not about what are the things that have happened in the past and how do you have roles to address them, but what are the things that, you think could occur in the future and how do you make sure roles don't stop the things that are good that could come in the future, and how do you address some of the things that might otherwise easily foreseeable be bad in the future. So it was a different way of thinking about regulation and how to regulate. And we'll come back to that in a moment. The other area that I thought was important was to understand the economics, for example, of things like market structure and competition. And so one of the things that always fascinated me just growing up, and I can actually remember actually standing at the subway with my father a long, long time ago when I was a kid, and looking at the stock tables that were in his hand and in the newspaper that he was carrying, and seeing everything in fractions. And, you know, I'd learned fractions in school, and I knew what they were, but I couldn't understand why everything else that I could read in the newspaper was always talking about dollars and cents, but when it came to stocks, everything was talking about fractions. And things were, you know, $14 and an eighth. And it's like, why are they in fractions? So I asked. And my father's reaction was, you know, I have no idea. And so it always just sort of sat in the back of my mind and never, I think, quite cared about it until I got to the SEC when I asked people in the first few weeks there, just out of curiosity, why are stocks traded in fractions? And found that most people had no idea. And the only rationale that people could come up with is, well, it's the way it's always been. And, you know, quite honestly, when you think about computers and about technology and about the fact that everything is currently, was then currently displayed in decimals, and people had spreadsheets in decimals, and what you showed printed out was in decimals, and that it would actually take effort to convert into fractions and then effort to convert back from fractions into decimals, it started to become a little bit strange because people were spending real money basically trying to maintain things in fractions as opposed to just converting to decimals. And so it didn't seem like it made sense that the only reason that we had fractions was because, well, we've always had fractions. It seemed like there was an economic reason for maintaining fractions that was going on. And so the investigation that we started at that time into why there were fractions led to the whole question of market structure, of tick size, of people being able to collude on keeping spreads artificially wide, and looking at institutions like InstantNet at the time that were basically set up in order to get in between spreads that otherwise were artificially wide, and realized that institutions were getting these prices, but individuals could not get these prices, and really starting to try to figure out what was going on. And the more I looked, the more it was obvious that, in essence, having fractions was just simply a means to keep an artificially wide tick size, which, from an antitrust perspective, somebody might look at as sort of an anti-competitive price-fixing concept of keeping artificially wide tick sizes. And the remedy was, therefore, to eliminate what was otherwise, at that point, being enforced by the SEC, as an artificially wide tick size, which was the fractions. And so the movement started to decimalize the markets and move away from quoting in fractions to quoting in pennies. That took some years after I left the commission to finally get implemented, but we were able to start moving that, that boulder to the point where it started to crash downhill while I was there. And it was inevitable when I left that it was going to happen, but it was still a couple of years away. So those are some of the things that that I thought were important to do. And in all those, I don't think there was any objection or difference of view as to the need for them over time from the chair's office. Mm-hmm. Consequently, the ability to act as two of us, I think we actually got a lot of things done, got it done pretty efficiently, and got it done reasonably well.
I like how you brought it around to the beginning of the question again. Number of follow-up questions. I think let's start with the last bit, of course. I was interested in your approach to the question of fractions and decimalization as being a question of why this was the way it was in the first place, since the way the story is usually told is in terms of the Stanford study on the odd eights on the NASDAQ, and then the 21A report. Was that something that crystallized action in your mind, that whole investigation, or was that what brought it up in the first place?
It certainly crystallized it. It certainly reinforced the notion that there is something odd here. Excuse the pun. But even that was more of taking an artificially wide tick size because of fractions and making it even wider by colluding to eliminate even one of those tick sizes. So the question still begged itself as to why are we doing this in the first place. What that report showed was that it's easier to collude if you only have a few stops, because everybody could sort of agree on, okay, we'll use odds or evens, etc. The real question was, why did you have those stops in the first place? So I think it was it sort of assumed, in a certain sense, the premise that fractions are here. It's just a question of people are seemingly only using certain fractions and seemingly, therefore, doubling the spread that would otherwise be available to investors. But that really sort of, I thought, missed the fundamental question of, you know, the tick size in the first place, and why would you have fractions?
That's very interesting. I ran into this isolated reference, and so I'm not sure if anything came of it at all, but I guess that after being in eighths, they went to sixteenths, and then there was a question of whether or not there was quotes being done in odd sixteenths. That kind of meshes with what you're saying about it being in fractions and kind of lending itself to collusion in that
exactly.
sort of way. Do you have any insight on that, if anything came of that sixteenths question?
In terms of...
Was there collusion on sixteenths as well as on eighths?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I don't know the data on that.
Okay.
So I don't think I can give you an informed view.
Okay.
But, you know, if you make it easy to collude and people can make money by colluding, I think you might expect that over time people will.
So going to back to the technology question in general, you talked, I gathered you were referring mainly to electronic disclosure and that sort of thing. But, of course, there are the order handling rules in Reg ATS in this period. Were you centrally involved in that as well?
Yeah.
Is that part
order
of that?
Order handling rules were important. You know, part of that was designed to, again, try to reach a number of these different issues. You know, part of my concern with the way the SEC then and I think, you know, has from before then and since then regulated is that it looks at an issue and then it attempts to have a specific role to address that particular issue. The problem is that as technology accelerates and as you have smart people looking at things, you end up with rules that try to micromanage how certain things occur. The result is two things. One is you end up with a sort of anchor to innovation, because you've got these very specific rules that say this precisely is how it shall occur. And anything else is not permitted, or these other things are not permitted, even if they might be good things in a different context. And so you basically head off good innovations that might come out of a new way of thinking about how somebody could approach a problem. At the same time, by sort of closing the barn door on things that have already occurred, that's fine. But people who are looking for ways to still get an advantage will find a different way. And you can keep on trying to do rules after rules, basically sort of a whack-a-mole type of approach. But ultimately that becomes, I think, a little bit self-defeating. It becomes very hard. And the rules become so complex and they build so much on each other that it becomes very hard for anyone to even understand what all the rules are, forget about really trying to comply with them. That, I think, is a really bad way for a set of laws to develop and for a set of regulations to develop. On the other side, however, take probably the most famous of all the SEC's rules, probably the most effective of all the SEC's rules, the most useful for all the SEC's rules across a whole wide variety of behavior, which is 10b-5. And a very simple rule. And one can summarize it as basically, thou shalt not lie. And it is terrific. it works in so many different places. It is so useful across so many different scenarios. It is understandable. It is something people can feel is worthwhile to enforce. And it enshrines a concept that people think is a just and reasonable way for people to act. That rule makes a lot of sense. And nobody has had to really do micromanaging on that rule for decades, actually almost a century at this point, or a little less than a century. That's I think, sort of an indicator of some rules that can stand the test of time, and others that almost by the time you adopt them, they're already outmoded and outdated. My fear is that as we look at some of these types of rules, you get more and more into very specific micromanagement of very particular items and issues, which enshrine current thinking from current incumbents as to what they want or what they're currently doing. And then that's basically where you end up. Part of what I wanted to do, and part of I wrote some articles about this, and part of what I was hoping would happen with some of the changes that we were able to put in place, was this notion of allowing, and Reg ATS certainly is part of this, for example, but it has become its own increasing set of regulatory burdens, and I think over time we'll see fewer and fewer innovations and fewer opportunities for people to do things that could solve other problems, was to allow a lot of different market venues to develop and to compete and to offer different kinds of trading, different kinds of rules, different kinds of order types, different kinds of things. And as there was more and more competition, more and more innovation, my view is over time that'll be better. I know there are different views on it. For example, I'm sure there are people, I don't know if you can find them today, but I'm sure there are people who think that if we just went back to AT&T having a monopoly on every phone in this country and everything was in one place, that would be better. It's the old sort of Bell system. And I remember people talking fondly about the fact that when their phone broke, they just ended up, calling the AT&T service provider and somebody would come back and give them a new phone. And no questions asked, no payments, nothing else. Today, your phone breaks, you got to take it in, you probably have to buy a new one. You own it, it's your problem, et cetera, et cetera. There's some people who lament the fact that we have competition in telecom now and think that the world would have been better if we had continued with the monopoly, just as we see today. People lamenting the fact that we have fragmentation in the markets and think that the world would be better if there was a monopoly. I find that interesting because in almost no walk of life other than in this industry do people continue to come back to the notion of we need monopolies. This industry, for whatever reason, continues to embrace the notion that there should be monopolies. And fragmentation is bad, competition is bad, having central facilities that do something is good, and we should just leave it at that. And that mindset makes a lot of sense if you don't believe in innovation, if you don't believe that there are disruptive new kinds of ways to think about how things can get done, if you don't believe that having lower prices and people thinking about how to compete with each other is a good idea. And if you do believe that having large enshrined incumbents is the right market structure or the right structure for the industry as a whole, then you are left with the view that we should continue to have the sort of rulemaking that stops innovation. But I don't subscribe to that, and I hope most people don't subscribe to that. Fragmentation, if it means it came about because of competition and because people were able to vie for market share because they had something new to offer, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. There may be consequences of some of that that somebody may not like, but you take the negatives with the positives and you try to make sure that on balance it continues to evolve in a way that's clearly beneficial. But to basically say, there could be a negative, so we won't let the positives emerge, I think it's a terrible mistake. And not suggesting anybody currently does that consciously or thinks about doing that, but I think the continuing weight of more and more micromanaged types of rules and regulations over time results in that. No one particular rule does. Every one particular rule is always generally viewed as beneficial on its face, or at least I think most people voting for a rule think it's beneficial. But the cumulative impact of all the rules is something that nobody votes on, but it's something that occurs.
At the same time, the discussions of modernization in the period focused a lot on deregulation. So it's after your time at the Commission, but of course you have Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. What were your views on those developments?
You know, I always thought the discussion between deregulation or more regulation really very much missed the point. I don't think anybody wants to live in a world that's got deregulated everything or no regulation. Nobody wants to drive down the street and find that the green light and red light is just precatory, and you know, if somebody decides to go through, they just go through it. We'd be in a state of carnage all over the place. I don't think anybody wants to go into a restaurant and sort of guess whether or not they're complying with any safe food handling rules. I think people want and need regulation that makes sense. I think the key is, does it make sense? Is it something that is well defined in the sense of, does it have a clear goal? Is that goal something that we really do embrace that does make sense? Is it something where the regulation itself is directed towards achieving that specific goal? And is the regulation flexible enough so that other ways of achieving that goal are permitted as opposed to prohibited? So I think that the issue never really is less or more regulation. It's how do you get really good regulation? How do you get it in a way that makes sense? And that's a really, really hard thing to do. It's easy to write bad regulations, and it's easy to simply vote to eliminate regulations. I think it's really hard to write good regulations, and that's, I think, the real task that the regulators need to rise to.
So in terms of those specific pieces of legislation, I mean, you have particular opinions on them, or is it?
You know, GLB and others are not simple pieces mm-hmm. that have one particular activity to them. Mm-hmm. They're a combination of a number of different provisions. So I think you'd have to actually go provision by provision mm-hmm. and talk about them specifically in order to determine whether or not you think on balance the legislation as a whole makes sense. You know, it's like Dodd-Frank. Mm-hmm. Are there provisions of Dodd-Frank that I think most people or many people would think are not very good provisions? I think the answer probably is yes. Would you condemn the entire legislative package because of that? I think, you know, probably most people or many people might say no. Could you make it better? Of course. Sure. You know, so it's the kind of thing where I think the ability to allow more things to happen in the sense of more and more competition is good. I think the problem that we've seen, and you can just see it in what's happened over the last half dozen years in this country with regard to the large banks, you know, we ended up in a great recession based on the notion that we had a systemic risk problem brought on in part by large financial institutions that ended up failing because of certain risky activities that they took in, that they engaged in. Put it simply that way. I think there are other views, but we'll leave it at that. The notion that we then would take government funds, a huge amount of effort, lots of work on the part of the Treasury and others, in order to take the large institutions that created this problem and that to some degree needed to be rescued by the government because they were perceived as too big to fail. And with huge amounts of effort, energy, and money, we then went to the effort of making them even bigger in this country and further concentrating the risk in the names of a few large financial institutions is truly stunning. Yeah, because if you think about the concept of we have concerns because we have these large institutions, And so let's, over the next few years, make them even larger by engaging in more mergers, subsidizing those mergers. That's just a stunning outcome. That's just a stunning outcome from the standpoint of public policy. And then to turn around and say, okay, so what we're now going to try to do is to regulate those institutions based on what? Based on our wonderful perceptive capabilities to foresightfully and foreseeably notice the problems that were occurring in the 05, 06, 07 timeframe. And we're going to take our great acumen, and now we're going to regulate these much, much larger institutions so that the same problems or similar kinds of problems won't exist again. That's really a stunning amount of arrogance. And so the obvious solution that one might want, which is to have market mechanisms in place to encourage those institutions to become no longer too big to fail, by simple things such as increasing capital ratios as you get larger and larger, et cetera. Those are the kinds of things that could have been put in place, but instead we have legislation that attempts to micromanage at a level that's never been seen before, I think, in the financial services sector, and is attempting to manage extraordinarily large institutions. That, I think, is a sad public policy occurrence and something that needs to be addressed going forward. Now, that's not stuff that occurred when I was there at the commission or in public service, but it's certainly some of the things that one can take note of over the last few years as indicia of where regulation and legislation, I think, can miss the sort of artery and go for the capillary.
I'd like to come back to the question of capital formation and registration. It seems to me that, looking at the history, there are a couple different issues that were being held at this time. I'm wondering if you can bring some clarity to the thinking. First, there's the question of state versus federal regulators in the National Securities Market Improvements Act. NSMIA, is it?
Yep.
Yeah, and then there's the issue that you addressed with the Advisory Committee on Capital Formation, which ultimately, well down the road, results with the development of well-known seasoned issuers. And I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about how deeply the thinking on these two issues was related, if they were two prongs of a larger attempt to create a more harmonized rule environment.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, NSMIA itself, I think, has some terrific advantages in the conceptualization of how you would want to have a national securities market. The notion that the blue sky laws of the various states should, in essence, trump the ability to offer securities in those states, which is what the law had been, so there was no preemption, I think was unfortunate. It was a clear expense, and it's not clear in terms of any data that any investor protection benefits really were obtained. The only sort of anecdotal story that comes out of companies that were barred from being able to issue securities in one state when other states let them go through, and therefore there was some presumed impact with regard to that, is actually the story of Apple, which was apparently barred from issuing its securities in Massachusetts because the Massachusetts regulator at the time thought that Apple was too speculative a company for anyone to want to invest in. Looking back and then looking forward, a pretty extraordinary, extraordinarily bad observation on the part of somebody. That doesn't necessarily mean that the notion of, at that point, merit regulation was always bad, but it does mean that there needed to be a somewhat deeper dive into what merit regulation really was trying to get at. And also the question of, if you're looking at heterogeneous views in the population as to what somebody can invest in, what do you want for investor protections in terms of how the sales process works and some other things, but you really want to substitute a person or a small group of people's personal view on whether or not something is speculative or not with the market's view on whether or not something is a worthwhile investment and something that might lead to great innovation. So I think there were some real questions as to whether or not what was going on at the state level at that time with some of the merit regulation types of reviews was serving a useful purpose.
Did that come out of, I noticed on your resume that you had, that you were a member of this Blue Ribbon Task Force on Federal-State Relations. Did that come out of that, or was that?
No, that was very different. The NISMIA-related question for the Art of Preemption, my personal view was, we have a national securities market. It ought to be viewed as a national securities market. The states have a very significant, very strong, very important role to play in terms of on-the-ground enforcement of the securities laws and the ability to ferret out bad sales practices and frauds that are going on at the more local or state level, various types of schemes that are hard for a federal enforcement agency to find, but that would be presumably much easier for a more local or state-based enforcement agency to be able to find. But to be able to not duplicate the constructs of what the SEC was doing in terms of disclosure requirements, things of that nature, that really just became a tax on capital formation and a constraint, not a benefit. So the NISMIA concept, I thought, was a very good one, and one that that did the right thing. Whether or not the definition of covered security really should have been tied into something listed on a national securities exchange, or whether or not it should have been tied into something that related to SEC regulation or registration, I think I would have a different view. I don't think tying it into whether or not some private sector organization decides to list something or not, or whether or not it's called an exchange or not, because, again, just take the technology. There are lots of ways for securities to be distributed at this point, or to be offered, or to be transacted, as opposed to there always having to be on a quote-unquote exchange. Yet, because of NISMIA, in order to get the benefit of the state preemption, if you will, you need to be on an exchange to be covered security. So that's sort of unfortunate. But the concept generally of at least being able to start to harmonize across all the jurisdictions in this country and have one federal regulatory rule made a lot of sense, especially when you start to think about international size transactions, where the notion that a large multinational or other organization, not only does it have to deal with the sovereigns of other countries in terms of their regulatory structure, but then when you get to the United States, you're not only looking at the SEC, but now you're looking at 50 states as well, really started to become a question of, does this actually scale in an increasingly small global world? So it just was against the grain of history. And, you know, the whole European Union, et cetera, is all moving towards a more consolidated construct of how you regulate with a more unified regulatory system, as opposed to these really sort of speed bump types of systems that mean that you have to spend a lot of time with a lot of lawyers to get through various very local or state hurdles to be able to offer securities. That's just a tax and not a very efficient one. So I thought NISBIR was very well formed. The Blue Ribbon panel on federal and state relations was really trying to focus on how do you get the best coordination between what the SEC can most usefully do and what some of the state blue sky regulators could most usefully do. So they were in essence sort of parallel discussions. I was a strong supporter of NISMIA, and also a strong supporter of what the states can do. Just that they can do things that are different from what the SEC can do. The SEC can do things different from the states can do, and they ought to be complementary to each other, not overlapping what each was doing. So that was the general gist of it.
How closely or distantly related were these discussions about creating a more unified, modernized regulatory framework to what later became the aircraft carrier release after you left?
You know, the aircraft carrier, which was going on in part while I was there, you know, I think some might view it as a sort of alternative approach to some of the things that the Advisory Committee on Capital Formation was starting to move forward on. You know, I think the notion of just sort of loading up all these rules or rule changes in some cases to try to modernize the securities laws was an approach. My view was there were some fundamental shifts that could more usefully resolve the problem. In a certain sense, it's sort of like my analogy was always sort of the notion of the debate between Ptolemy and you know, sort of the Copernicus way of thinking about things. You can imagine that it all has to change, it all has to be the same way that it is today, and you can put in more and more circles and more things to try to describe the stuff that you're seeing that doesn't fit with your worldview, and try to keep making some rationale as to how it could possibly fit, so that you can still have the Earth in the center and everything else revolve around it. Or you can basically say, yeah, maybe the Earth isn't in the center. Maybe the Sun's in the center for this purpose. And then all of a sudden, everything starts to become much simpler again. The aircraft carrier, I think, was a paradigm example of something that took something that, that was at some point starting to become too difficult to continue to rationalize, mm-hmm. and added more and more and more stuff to it, which is why it's called the aircraft carrier, because it's carrying everything, mm-hmm. To try to explain how it could still sit with its current core thinking and still be a little bit more forward-thinking and evolve. Whereas what we were proposing with the company registration concept was just a rethinking of some of the underlying core principles that would make the whole structure just much, much simpler.
I'm detecting shades of Tom Kuhn's structure of the scientific revolution. Are you familiar with the...
A little bit.
Not too much. That's yes. Very interesting. One of the more divisive issues while you were there was the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act. I'm wondering if you could tell me about your perspective on that whole debate leading up to it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It comes in part from a question of what do you think the data show? What it seemed to show at the time was that the number of lawsuits that were being brought and the remedies that were obtained were not advancing shareholder interests very much or protecting investors. They were primarily enriching a class of lawyers who were bringing the cases. Moreover, what a lot of it was a transfer of wealth from the corporation, a.k.a. the shareholders at that point, to the shareholders, presumably, but with a large slice, a third or more, going to the lawyers. And in some cases, it was even worse, where all the money would go to the lawyers, and then there would be sort of a structural reform or a bylaw change or something agreed to presumably benefit the shareholders. And that seemed like a remarkably inefficient way to try to both ensure that people were complying with the law, to enforce regulation, and to try to ensure fairness in the marketplace. It also seemed to me that you have a governmental agency, aka the SEC, that is charged with those kinds of activities. And many of the complaints that were being filed with the courts by plaintiffs' lawyers were all premised on securities law violations. And so why wouldn't the SEC, as the primary regulator of the securities laws and the primary enforcer of the securities laws, actually be bringing those complaints instead, but doing it as a governmental agency on behalf of the investors that are to be protected, as opposed to as a private plaintiff doing it and taking a very, very large swath of any recovery on top of it? So it seemed to me that it just wasn't a very efficient system. It wasn't a very fair system. And the economics, going back again to sort of asking the question about the economics, were clear that the cost of filing a complaint was just absolutely immaterial compared to the potential return that you could get if you got the settlement from the company. And in fact, you had an incentive, a very perverse one, to file as many complaints as you can, as quickly as you can. And then settle as fast as you can for whatever you can get, provided that it's a good return for you, the lawyer, regardless of what happens with the shareholders. That's not a very good system of justice. It's not a very good way to suggest that the framework should work. And you know, the counter view is, well, the SEC has limited resources. It can't enforce the law as much as having a whole bunch of private actors enforcing the law could do. That in some cases the SEC would look at a case and say, we just don't think there's a there, but a plaintiff's lawyer, you know, being tenacious and pugnacious and much more willing to dig in, might find something. My view on that was always, well, the SEC should get more resources. Mm-hmm. It should be a little bit more tenacious and pugnacious. It should be better at analyzing cases and really determining there is something more there. But it shouldn't basically assume that it only fails and that it's not very effective and that it's impotent to actually protect investors. And so it needs this backstop of the plaintiff's lawyers to be able to do its job. And I thought the SEC could simply do better. Mm-hmm. The SEC could put itself in a position to actually do what it should be doing as a government enforcing regulator. You know, and when you think about it, we have sort of government doing that in lots of other walks of life. And we generally expect government to be able to step up and do a lot of those things. But in this case, the government sort of took this position that it needed to cede much of its jurisdiction and authority and its potential for doing good to the private bar. And that just seemed to me to be wrong. And it seemed economically inefficient, and it seemed like it had perverse incentives. Mm-hmm. Moreover, when you look at it, it also became apparent that plaintiffs' lawyers, for example, weren't going after small companies that didn't have a lot of money because it wasn't worth their time. And so you ended up with smaller companies being a little bit more immune, and larger companies, just whenever there's a stock drop, there'd be a complaint filed, even if nobody knew what the complaint was about yet. But if the stock had dropped, then there must be something. And consequently, you ended up in this very strange universe of whenever there's a stock drop, all of a sudden you ended up with a lawsuit, even if there was nothing there, and ultimately it would be dismissed. But it became much easier for corporations to sit there and say, well, we can go through trial, we can spend a few million dollars defending it, or we can just try to settle this and insurance will cover a good amount of it, or all of it. And that just seemed like a wrong way for policy to develop.
One of the interesting contexts here, I think, is in terms of the SEC's ability to assert itself. I think there was some notion that certainly the Clinton administration at that time wasn't a defender of the SEC, and so there was difficulty in getting resources, and even the fact that it had only two commissioners for so long was sort of symbolic of that general attitude. Do you think that was kind of the attitude among the people who wanted to have private litigation be a stronger tool to use in it?
To be honest, I've not heard that, so I don't have any informed opinion on that. And I always interpreted the delay in adding more commissioners to the White House's view that we must be doing a great job.
Okay.
Quite honestly, no, I've not heard the notion that the Clinton administration didn't care about the SEC. I always was of the view that they did, mm-hmm. and that they thought it was moving along smoothly and doing what it should be doing.
It was one of those things that was battered around in the press at the time, so you can never tell exactly how much.
Yeah,
read into it.
There was obviously a lot on the mind of the mm-hmm. president. I'm not sure that the SEC was probably the top of the agenda item mm-hmm. every morning at the morning briefing, but I certainly never got the impression that the commission was viewed as a backwater, unimportant, and irrelevant, or anything else.
How engaged were you with the Chairman Leavitt's priority on auditor independence? I noticed an interesting line in your bio about being involved in the stock options accounting debate in mm-hmm. particular. So I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about that.
The auditor independence issue is one where clearly, and we've seen it come to light with what happened with Anderson, et cetera, but the auditor independence issue is obviously an important one. And auditors are the sort of backstop for corporate financial accounting, corporate financial fraud to be ferreted out, et cetera. We need auditors. We need them to do their job well, and we need them to be independent of management. So having a strong sense of auditor independence and what that means, I think, is really critical. I think the question is, again, like anything else, you know, do the rules make any sense in some cases? I know there was at least one case where I think an audit firm was owned by a public corporation, if I got the facts right, and if somebody owned one share of stock of the public corporation, the audit firm is viewed as not independent of the audit company if the audit company happened to own a share of that stock. That seems silly on its face. And so, you know, again, if people could come up with more thoughtful ways of enforcing and interpreting some of the rules, you'd probably end up with a somewhat better view of the regulator and the rules than some seem to have, certainly at that time and afterwards. But the concept of auditor independence is just absolutely critical, and I'm very supportive of it and think it makes a lot of sense. With regard to sort of other questions about stock options and the accounting for them, a little bit different. That gets to not the auditor independence issue. That gets to the question of what's the substantive gap sort of accounting for particular activities. And stock options is a very interesting one because when people look at the bottom line of a company and look at the earned income, they normally think of it as money that's earned. When you think of compensation expense, people normally think of it as money that's paid out. And you would expect the money that's paid out to be subtracted from the money that is taken in by the company to result at the end of the day with a number that's impacting the money that's earned. The issue that I had with stock options is when you look at it, there's no question that they're compensation. That's not the issue. Of course they're compensation. The question was how you account for them in terms of how they flow through some of the financial records. And the notion that you would take a company and say, if you gave a stock option to somebody, and now the stock has gone up tenfold, let's say, we're going to now take the position that, therefore, you have given much, much more value to that employee than they had had before, means that as the company does better, it actually ends up with much, much higher charges because of a decision that was made to give stock options in a previous time frame. And the problem with that is you can actually get into these really silly presentations of financial information where a company that's doing really very, very well and is perceived in the marketplace generally to be doing well so that its stock price is going up, but has no earnings and continues to show no earnings because it keeps having an increasing charge for the cost of stock options. And that's just somewhat misleading for people. And then you also get the reverse, where a company that's not doing anywhere close as well in terms of real life might end up with much higher reported earnings because its stock compensation, stock option compensation expense would be so much lower. So the general concept of how to account for it is what I was attempting to suggest people could think about a little bit better. And the proposal was a very simple one, which was simply to add it as an additional item, just like we have EBITDA, where you go back, subtract out depreciation, amortization, interest, taxes for various purposes when you're showing an income line, was to be able to have another line basically for stock option compensation so people could see it, it would be transparent, you could see exactly what it was doing, but it wouldn't mess up the actual earned income number per se that could be reported. That is sort of anathema to a number of accountants, auditors, who think that there's got to be ultimately just one reportable net income number, and having this extra disclosure separately from the compensation line was not something that sort of fit within the mindset, and consequently, you know, we have the rule we have. As long as people understand it, as long as people know it, and as long as there's subsequent other disclosure, as there is on stock option compensation, so people can go back and say, okay, well, now I get it. The reason this company keeps showing a loss is because it's got this huge stock option compensation expense, but in fact, it's not paying out money. It's part of the capital structure. So yes, it impacts investors, but it's very different. A company doesn't go bankrupt by having the stock option compensation expense there, as opposed to a company that's really losing money and is going bankrupt. As long as that's clear, as long as people understand it, I think it is fine either way. I just thought at the time people asked, I suggested an alternative, and it was a bitterly fought issue on the part of some high tech companies some on the FASB side for an issue that just seemed like it could easily have been resolved by more transparency in a much, much easier way, where everybody could have basically come out with the right answer in terms of what they were trying to show, which is, I'm doing a great job running my company, and done such a great job that there's this extra stock option compensation expense, and the auditors could say, yes, but it is in fact compensation, and it should be shown as compensation. So you could have had a good way of showing both that would have been relatively straightforward. Again, it's sometimes, I always find it interesting when it is hard to think about sort of bigger changes as opposed to little tweaks. The world works on little tweaks, and that's in many cases, at least this part of the world works on little tweaks, and that's unfortunate in many cases. I think what we're seeing is technology and other things really, to use the cliched and way overused term at the moment, disrupting various areas as people rethink some fundamental concepts. But when it comes to regulation and when it comes to much of public policy and things of that nature, it is surprising how the ability to rethink some fundamental concepts is just so difficult to do. And instead, what you end up with are very, very modest tweaking of existing provisions that have been in place for a long time.
Another of Chairman Leavitt's early initiatives was in the area of municipal securities. I talked about this with Paul Mako and with Dick Walker yesterday, mm-hmm. trying to build a mosaic of enforcement cases, because really the SEC's only jurisdiction is under the fraud provisions. Paul Mako had an interesting story about getting a 2 a.m. phone call from you, talking about issuers' personal responsibility and being very careful on that ground. But that, of course, that's just a fragment of what might be a broader perspective of yours. And so I'm wondering if you could discuss that a little bit.
Well, if I called him at 2 a.m., I hope he was somewhere in Europe, and it just happened to be that we didn't know what time zone he was on. Because that seems unfair to do that to somebody. But in terms of the municipal securities area, Chairman Leavitt's efforts there, I thought, were extraordinarily laudable. I mean, it was an area that had lots of different issues. The pay-for-play issue was really, I thought, one that was at the best, one would look at it as corrupt. At the worst, it was sort of clearly criminal. And I thought his efforts to ferret that out, to come up with some rulemaking that could address it, to try to stop it from continuing to become the persistent and the normal way that people thought about municipal securities underwriting activities and local political fundraising was really important and really critical. I think that was a hallmark achievement and a terrifically important one.
So I'm conscious that you have a 12:30 meeting, and we're probably getting up close to the time that you have to take off. There are a couple of areas. First is your interest in shareholder democracy, as you put it. And I'm wondering, this is past the time when people were discussing the one share, one vote question, as far as I know. But there's a question of shareholder proposals and all that sort of thing. And I see that, again, from your bio, that you're part of something called Proxy Governance Incorporated after you left the SEC. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can discuss your interest in that subject and how that developed.
Sure. Proxy Governance, Inc. is something that I founded a number of years ago. It has since been dismembered and sold off in two component pieces to some others. One part went to Glass Lewis, another part went to an accounting firm. The interest that I have in that area is again, sort of the overall construct of corporate governance, sort of general, writ large areas of interest. And I think what you're probably referring to is when I was at the commission, there is a series of questions that came up about something called Rule 14A8, which is shareholder proposal rule. And in particular, there were some proposals at the time that were related to what was called ordinary business, the ordinary business exception. And probably the most infamous of them was one that related to a company called Cracker Barrel, which at that time people were claiming it was discriminating with regard to hiring certain employees. And there was a proposal submitted by a shareholder to request data, to require the board to do an investigation and to disclose what kind of hiring practices it had and whether or not there were issues of potential discrimination in terms of its practices, and if so, to fix them. The staff took the position that that really relates to the ordinary business of the company in terms of its hiring practices and how it engages in screening and what it does. My view was that, you know, discrimination is not ordinary business. And if a company is engaged in discrimination, that's just not ordinary business. And exempting that or accepting out that proposal and not having it included on the grounds that it was relating to ordinary business were just simply wrong. So that was part of the sort of original set of thinking that led me to look more at 14AA and how the shareholder proposal system was sort of working all together. And I wish I'd pushed further at the time on that, because I think it has continued to take an extraordinary amount of time at the commission. It continues to be an area where I think there are lots of other solutions at this point that could be sort of opening up the opportunity for many shareholders to propose many other things of interest to other shareholders. I think you could get much more shareholder engagement if there is the opportunity for more discussion. But so many of the SEC's rules limit shareholder discussion, make it hard, and really sort of, again, centralize the management of the shareholder discussion process that I think it's serving at this point no good purpose. I think you could, again, relook at that whole rule structure and come up with a different approach to how you would allow shareholder proposals to be includable or made available to shareholders to both see, comment on, and vote on than what we have today.
Kind of struck by an interesting parallel. I mean, both you and Chairman Breeden before your time on the commission were interested in the question of shareholder power, and both of you afterwards, he through the creation of an activist hedge fund, continued to pursue this area. It's quite interesting. So unless there's something else that you feel it's pressing that we talk about, I'd like to talk a little bit about your time after the SEC, and particularly how you decided to start this company, Folio.
Folio started with the idea of if you took the technology of the time, which has obviously gotten better, and rethought, for example, the sort of ability to provide investment management to individual investors, would you create and invent a mutual fund, or would you create or invent something else? And sort of that simple thought exercise, if you will, led to the view that you would create a mutual fund. The structure is a structure that it was created in the 30s and 40s. It was a good structure at the time, but technology, by the time you got to the end of the century, had evolved sufficiently that you could do something much more efficient and much better. And so the concept of sort of folios was born. The concept of having the ability for people to put together a whole basket of stocks that could reflect any kind of theme, any kind of investment style, any kind of structure, any kind of geography or sector, industry, or other construct as to how you might want to put together a portfolio, and make that a customizable, personalizable portfolio that somebody could cost effectively buy. That was sort of part of that view, that isn't that a better way to do it than a mutual fund? I also wanted to do something else, which is a good amount of my time at the SEC was also spent obviously talking to investor groups and investors and others about investing and how better to invest, et cetera. There's an investor education component to being at the SEC and being in commission. And one of the things that struck me quite hard was when you get to individual investors, large institutions could do this all the time, but large institutions learned their lessons, but they weren't being handed out to individuals, and individuals were being told you should personalize your investments and make sure it fits your needs, but they didn't know how to do that. And you should diversify, but it was hard to figure out how to diversify. And you should worry about taxes, and individual investors really didn't have any good way of worrying about taxes. And of course, people were being told to be cost sensitive and think about costs. And then people were being told, of course, to be consistent, that one of the things we always see, all the behavioral finance even then was clearly pointing out, was that individual investors always do the bad thing of buying high because the market is going up and they all decide to get in once the market has shown that it is moving well and increasing. So people buy high and then they wait, and when the market is really starting to have problems and is struggling and has gone down and they've lost value, they start to get very concerned that it might go down even further and they sell. And that cycle of buying high and selling low is just not a good way to basically accumulate wealth. So the idea was, could you take those principles? Could you take the idea of diversification, of personalization, of consistent investing, of tax minimization, if you will, tax optimization, and low costs, and build something that would give a vehicle to individual investors that would allow them to, in essence, practice those five principles well? And I thought you could. I thought you could compete into existence a new way for investors to invest. And you know, part of what I learned at the commission is that you could spend a lot of time regulating out of existence bad things, but you can't really regulate into existence really novel good things. You can make sure that maybe nothing's in the way of doing that, but it's up to the private sector to create the innovative new good things. It's up to the public sector, the regulators, to basically stop the bad things. So I wanted to, when I left the commission, and I was no longer in a position where all I could do was stop bad things, was to see if we could really compete into existence novel good things. And I thought it was important to sort of take these five principles, take technology as it then was evolving, and see if you could, in essence, create a whole new platform, a whole new structure for primarily individual investors and the people who serve them, investment advisors, for example, and others, to be able to invest in a smarter, better way. And that was really the genesis of Folio.
Do you have a particular sort of investor in mind? It seems that you're kind of have a middle way between the mutual fund, where it's very hands-off in certain cases, such as index funds, low cost. On the other hand, you have people who would invest in individual stocks via, say, in the internet broker. Is there one side or the other that you saw as your target customer, or were you really kind of trying to go for both ends of that?
Trying to go for both ends, because folios really are advantaged, obviously, over mutual funds. They're personalizable. You can't personalize a mutual fund. They're much more tax efficient than a mutual fund. They can be lower cost than a mutual fund. You invest consistently, mutual funds do just as well. And the diversification mutual funds do just as well. But when it comes to the personalization and some of the other things, folios are actually better. When you look at the individual stock buying that goes on, clearly they're not diversification. They're not diversified. So folios do that much better. They can be obviously individualized. You can pick one stock and it can be what you want. Folios do that as well. And when you get to the idea of costs, the idea of building a diversified portfolio out of individual stocks at any other brokerage is basically impossible. It's just too expensive. The idea of building a diversified portfolio of individual stocks here is trivial and very low cost. So we wanted to basically say to mutual fund investors, here's a better way, and to the people investing in individual stocks one at a time, here's a better way. Mm-hmm. And we thought we could, in essence, take the best of what mutual funds had to offer and the best of what investing in individual stocks has to offer and put it into one platform, one vehicle, one package that would allow people to get the benefits of both.
How quickly did this notion catch on to the effect that you were able to sustain the business? Was it something that customers understood readily?
It's a good question. I mean, the reality is that for individual investors, it is still hard. Not only was it then, but it still is. Individual investors still have some struggles with understanding diversification and what that really means. There are some sort of still, behavioral incentives for people to think about how they should invest, and getting people to invest consistently is still somewhat hard, et cetera. So there are some, and cost is another very interesting one. For example, Most individual investors really don't have a real clue as to how much they're paying to be in a mutual fund. One can tell them, well, it's 132 basis points or whatever, but nobody knows what that really means. In any event, they don't do the math. And so somebody will be sitting there with $100,000, and you'll say, you could be paying 100 basis points in here, and they don't sort of do the math to say, okay, so that's, you know, what is that? That's $1,000, right? Oh, goodness, I didn't think I was paying $1,000, 1% to be in this mutual fund. I thought it was much less. So that's what you hear from people all the time. The bottom line problem, therefore, is that on the individual investor side, the financial literacy and the level of education of a wide variety of people is not as high as one might expect. And I think that's a real goal and aspiration that the Commission should embrace, which is how do we encourage better investor education? How do you get better financial literacy in this country? And that's a real problem. And you know, it's something that probably ought to be taught in high school. People ought to be given a lot more financial literacy than they are. But the problem, therefore, is on the individual investor side, we have attracted a very, very good customer base, a very smart, thoughtful, reasonably well-educated, reasonably well-off investors who understand the benefits of what we provide and have embraced it. What we haven't been able to do, which is part of my disappointment on that part, is reach out to the whole wide group of people that could be benefited by this, but don't know that they could be. And you know, we need to try to figure out how to rectify that. On the other hand, on the investment advisor side and introducing broker-dealer side, others who serve individual investors, as soon as we launched, they understood exactly the benefits of what our platform could provide. And that part of the business has grown quite considerably. So from the standpoint of a platform for other broker-dealers, investment advisors, other financial intermediaries, the platform has done very, very well. And you know, we pioneered the whole concept of sort of themes-based investing, of portfolio-based investing. Advisors very frequently will have their own portfolios, their own models that they want to manage, and our platform just works perfectly for them. So that's been the part that has really taken off the best. We're now, at this point in our history, we're about 15 years old, thinking about how can we best get back into the sort of retail side and reach out to that individual investor to grow that base and hopefully really bring the wonders of diversification and cost effectiveness and tax optimization, consistent investing and personalization investing to a wider group of individual investors.
On your website, you mentioned you have a number of patents. Are those mainly elements of the platform?
We have a lot of patents, some of which we have practiced and are clearly elements of the platform. For example, we have something called that we call internally a text football, which is a, I think it's just great. It's a mechanism for somebody to visually get an entire view of the tax lots in their account, which could be tens of thousands, and then with a couple of clicks, be able to actually get the exact tax result that they want. It's really pretty stunning, and people who have looked at it are just amazed by it. It's just great. So we have a patent on that. We also have some patents on things that we haven't practiced yet. We have a risk manager concept that allows someone to actually bound their portfolio in terms of how much downside risk they're willing to take in exchange for how much upside are they willing to give up. That's one I'd like to bring to market at some point, but we haven't yet. And then we have a number of others that are in that category where I think that they would be great innovations, and we want to bring them to market. We just haven't yet. We've had no shortage of things to do and no shortage of things to build out, so we've been very blessed with all that.
That's a very interesting business. If you have anything else you'd like to mention, please feel free to, but otherwise I've pretty much run to the end of my list.
Yeah, the only other thing that that I would think that I find interesting, at least, are the things left undone. The things that you know, if you were able to extend out the commission time with the knowledge of what you know post being at the commission, would you have done anything differently while at the commission? In other afterwards. If you could basically say, if I knew then what I know now, would I have done anything differently or more or whatever? And that's something, you know, I think is always an interesting thing to think about, because it's always the kind of thing that, having left the commission, you sort of like to be able to tell people at the commission they should know about, because it's the kind of thing at least I would have liked to have known about when I was there. And I think you end up with a few. One is that, be careful what you hear in terms of the folks that come in and talk to you, because what I found was that it was sometimes very difficult to get speech, get voice, get knowledge, get information from people who were not the normal folks who deal with the commission every day. And so the benefit of the Investor Advisory Committee that I'm now on, that was established by Dodd-Frank and that advises the SEC, I think is really important, because the intent of that Investor Advisory Committee is to give voice to primarily individual investors who really otherwise don't show up at the commission and knock on the door and get access to commissioners' offices or others. And so the big firms are there every day, other big mutual fund complexes are there every day, the large issuers are there every day. I mean, there's voice there, the large institutional investors are there every day. But the individual investor just doesn't really get its voice heard. So I think it's important to try to ferret out that information more if you're a commissioner, and just always try to keep thinking about how this has real impacts on individual investors as well. The other thing is to really think about the difference between a principles-based rule and a more precise, sort of very specific micromanaged type rule. And this goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, but I think it's really, if I could go back even more, I would try to make sure that all the rules that I saw, not just the ones that I was able to focus on the most, but all the rules, really were much more principles-based, as opposed to really trying to get down to a micromanaging area. Because technology and the world just changes too fast. And so I think we really have a disservice when we put into stone sort of how something was, because that's how incumbents engaged in it at that time. And we have a rule that basically enshrines something that they do or strives to stop something that somebody did, as opposed to more general principles-based rules that really can live a longer life. And also at the same time, because it's a principle that you're enforcing, not a specific rule, can allow good things to happen. So to give you a specific example, there's a series of rules on prohibited transactions that basically say that if you're an advisor in the Advisors Act, you shouldn't be able to trade against your customer unless you get the specific consent of your customer on that particular transaction. And in fact, under the DOL rules with regard to ERISA, they have a prohibited transaction rule, and unless you get a class exemption for them, you're not allowed to have it. But that means that if you have a system that basically allows for customer orders to interact with a house account to get increased price improvement compared to what they would be able to get when they are sent out to market, that means that you can't actually make that offering available if you're deemed to be an advisor or fiduciary on those accounts. And so you get this perverse, really silly result, which says that because you're actually an advisor or fiduciary on that account, you end up sending those orders out to market where they get worse executions than what you would have been able to do if you had been able to cross them with a house account and given them a better execution. So people to whom you don't owe that fiduciary obligation get better executions than the people to whom you do, because of a rule that's intended to protect the people to whom you are supposed to be a fiduciary. So it's those kinds of rules that are very specific in terms of what they say you can and cannot do, but they don't think about the principle. And if the principle had been, if you're going to interact with your own customer orders, you have to ensure that they have a price or benefit at least equal to what they could have gotten from a third party, then you basically accomplish the same thing, but you allow for good things to happen as well. And it's just an example of the kind of thing where you could have written the rule in an intelligent, thoughtful way to allow good things to happen, but it was written in a way that basically tries to just stop one bad thing that was seen at the time. But in the meantime, it also stops a lot of other bad things. So the whole notion of principles-based regulation, I think, is really, really critical for any regulator to embrace and to try to then figure out how to incorporate it in what they do going forward. So those would be just some of the bigger issues. And then the only last one is really the underlying sort of industry plumbing is one that has never been able to get attention at the commission, certainly at the commission level. And I regret that when those issues came up to me, it was like, do I have to deal with this? And, can't the staff deal with this? And they just never got my attention. But as I now see the impact of some of the way that the industry structures itself on competition and on how it is really, in many cases, benefiting incumbents or large firms, it becomes a real problem because it becomes very anti-competitive. And in a world that's not so heavily regulated, you wouldn't care because somebody would come up with disruptive ways around those things and just do it. But in a world that's so heavily regulated and you've got these rules that basically say you have to do the following things, and they then have industry structures that basically enforce those rules and put in place provisions that make it very expensive if you don't do them or impossible if you don't do them, you end up getting forced into one mold. And it's the mold that gives the large firms the advantage because they're the ones who wrote the rules. And that's something I would have liked to have paid more attention to at the commission. I think it's a very important issue in terms of wanting to have competition and innovation going forward. And it's one that's hard to get people's attention because it doesn't rise to the level of some of the more easily understood types of activities that you can see how you write a rule with respect to. So it's that's a real problem because it's the kind of stuff where when you're talking about the plumbing of something, it just seems sort of below what you're able to do because it's not at a high enough level. You have to get into all the details and into the weeds. And as a commissioner, there are so many things, it's hard to get into that many weeds. But it's the kind of thing where there needs to be some way of addressing some of the institutions that have grown up in this industry that result in some of the, I think, bad things that we currently see.
Excellent. Thanks. You very much live up to your reputation as being somebody with a very thoughtful, intellectual approach to questions of regulation, and I very much appreciate your time. Thank you.
Absolutely. I don't know if that's good or bad.
No, I think it's, certainly as somebody trained in the humanities and history, I'm attracted to it myself.
Very good.
All right, thanks.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.